guys, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. It's official. We've just passed the vernal equinox. Spring is here, and not a moment too soon. This winter was one for the record books, but now we're looking forward to more time outdoors, being more active, even anticipating time at the beach or pool in a bathing suit. Yes, it's definitely the right time to think more about health and fitness, the topic of our show today. We'll preview new titles on nutrition, get fitness advice from some very recognizable names, and hear samples of impactful books by physicians on the state of medicine. My guest, Katherine Price, is the author of Vitamania, a fascinating read that sheds light on an industry that seems to change its emphasis and recommendations every week. Let's start our spring shape up as we turn to page one of the book report. Today, a buck can buy you a fast food burger. But what's the real cost of that meal? The rates of chronic disease, like diabetes, caused by our lifestyles have grown exponentially in recent years. America seems set to have this generation live shorter lives than their parents. Finding good nutrition, with more Americans living in cities far from a farmer's field, is a challenge. To overcome distance and undercut price, we rely on industry to put dinner on the table. Yet this system has valued efficiency and short-term profits over our own health and the health of our environment. In the real food revolution, healthy eating, green groceries, and the return of the American family farm, Congressman Tim Ryan, who narrates, lays out the problems we face and gives easy, actionable steps, from starting an herb garden to helping implement food education in schools to petitioning your elected officials. President Clinton comments, "Congressman Tim Ryan isn't afraid to take on a challenge, and he's gearing up for one of America's biggest, our health." In the Real Food Revolution, he delivers a straightforward and much-needed prescription to help transform our country's food systems and improve our well-being.
Treat the whole problem of health in soil, plant, animal, and man as one great subject. Sir Albert Howard. There is one place where nearly everything that matters today in the world converges, our fork. Food, the way we produce it and consume it, is the nexus of most of our world's health, environmental, economic, and even political crises. Luckily, there are voices out there working to create a food system that bolsters rather than undermines our world. They're fighting for what Congressman Tim Ryan calls a real food revolution. And that's exactly what Tim so eloquently, simply, and self-evidently describes in this book. Why would a doctor be so interested in food and food policy? Here's why. Never before have we seen a global crisis of chronic disease on the scale we currently face. Lifestyle-caused disease now kills 50 million people a year, more than twice as many as infectious disease. Today, half as many people go to bed hungry as go to bed overweight. And one in two Americans and one in four teenagers has prediabetes or type 2 diabetes. We are raising the first generation of Americans who will live sicker and die younger than their parents. Looking beyond simply our lower quality of life, we can see that our poor health affects our country and our world in larger ways. According to the World Economic Forum, chronic disease is now the single biggest threat to global economic development. It will cost the world's economy $47 trillion over the next 20 years, more than the annual gross domestic product, or GDP, of the six biggest economies combined. Our children's future is threatened by an achievement gap caused in large part by their inability to learn well after consuming the processed foods and sugar served in schools. 50% of schools serve brand-name fast foods in the cafeteria, and 80% have contracts with soda companies. Most schools now have only deep fryers and microwaves, which are only able to serve up industrial food-like substances prepared by corporations, not by humans. We are also depleting nature's capital. Capital that once destroyed cannot be reclaimed. 1 acre of arable land is lost to development every minute of every day. 1 pound of meat requires 2,000 gallons of water and produces 58 times more greenhouse gases than 1 pound of potatoes. Our industrial animal factory farms produce more methane and greenhouse gases and use more fossil fuels than all forms of transportation combined, air, car, ship, and train. We are destroying our rivers, our lakes, and oceans by the runoff of nitrogen-based fertilizers and pesticides. And 3/4 of our fresh water on the planet is used for agriculture, mostly to grow meat for human consumption. Wars of the future will be fought over water, not oil.
That was a sampling of The Real Food Revolution by Tim Ryan. Most of us know nothing about vitamins. What's more, what we think we know is harming both our personal nutrition and our national health. By focusing on vitamins at the expense of everything else, we've become blind to the bigger picture. Despite our belief that vitamins are an absolute good, and the more of them the better, vitamins are actually small and surprisingly mysterious pieces of a much larger nutritional puzzle. Catherine Price is an award-winning journalist who's written for The New York Times, Popular Science, Salon, Men's Health, and many others. In Vitamania, she offers a lucid and lively journey through our cherished yet misguided beliefs about vitamins and reveals a straightforward, blessedly anxiety-free path to enjoyable eating and good health. Our executive producer, Derek Hewitt, speaks with her today.
Hello, Catherine. Thank you for joining us on The Book Report.
Thanks for having me.
In the book, you talk about how Vitamania is upon us. So, should we all be taking a multivitamin every day?
Well, that's a loaded question there. I'd start off by saying, just to make sure we're talking about the same things, I always like to clarify what I actually mean when I say vitamin. Because most of the time when I tell people I'm writing a book about vitamins, they tend to ask me about things that aren't actually vitamins, like chondroitin supplements or omega-3 fatty acids and stuff like that. So just to lay out at the beginning, a vitamin, there's actually only 13 of them, and they are dietary chemicals that we require in small amounts and usually get from our diets that prevent a specific deficiency. And those vitamins are A, D, E, K, C, and the 8 B vitamins. And those are the ones that typically are found in a multivitamin in addition to the minerals. But that category does not include this much larger variety of dietary supplements in the American marketplace, which is like 85,000 products. But to get to your question about the multivitamin, you know, it's hard to answer that question without knowing what you eat. So I can say that there's no major health organization in the U.S. that recommends the routine use of multivitamins by otherwise healthy people. And so the question there becomes, all right, well, who's an otherwise healthy person? You know, who are the people who are not otherwise healthy? And there are specific conditions or dietary choices that might mean that you need supplementation of your diet. But in general, I think the most important question people should ask themselves is, what are you actually eating? You know, are you eating a diet of foods that naturally contain a lot of vitamins? Like, are you the type of person who is eating your kale salad daily and starting off your day with blueberries and walnuts, things like that? Then you're probably totally fine, and you're getting all sorts of other good stuff. And then are you the kind of person who, you know, wakes up in the morning with a bottle of Coke and potato chips, foods that actually don't have any vitamins that are added to them and don't have any natural vitamins either? In that case, you may need extra vitamins. I mean, I'd suggest maybe you change your diet, but you should pay attention to vitamins. And then you have this, like, huge middle category that I would say encompasses probably most Americans, where we eat the healthy fruits and vegetables sometimes, but we also eat a lot of processed and packaged foods that have synthetic man-made vitamins added to them. And if you're eating a lot of those products, like breakfast cereals or sports bars or vitamin drinks, you're probably just fine on vitamins. You may be missing out on other good things in food, but in terms of vitamins, your bases are covered.
In the book, you point out that while drugs are heavily regulated, supplements are not. How much harm is being caused by the fact that dietary supplements are not required to be tested for safety?
Yes, the dietary supplements and, as you say, dietary supplements are not required to be tested for safety or efficacy before they're sold in the United States. And this came about as a result of a 1994 law heavily influenced by the supplement industry, and that's been in effect ever since. In terms of what kind of danger that's posing to the American public, it is impossible to know because no one is testing these things for safety or efficacy. I mean, I can tell you that there have been scary instances where people are creating supplements that contain things in them that should not be in supplements. For example, a couple years ago, the former FDA commissioner sent a letter to dietary supplement makers saying that things had been found in some of these supplements, including stuff like anticoagulant drugs, anticonvulsants, sexual enhancement drugs like Viagra, all sorts of things that you would not, you know, illegal stimulants, things that should not be in supplements and in fact make those supplements illegal, but are being sold on the shelves. And since no one is proactively evaluating them, they can really hurt people. They can, just as one example, there's a problem with Olympic athletes or serious athletes who think that they're just taking supplements for bodybuilding or whatever, and then they test positive on drug tests, and then they can't compete. And they're completely innocent in the situation because they thought they were taking something that was legal.
You describe a very interesting transgenerational effect, suggesting that we are what our parents ate, and our children may be similarly affected too. Can you talk about how what we are eating today may affect future generations?
Sure. There's an emerging area of science known as epigenetics that's very much in its infancy. But the idea is that in addition to our genome or our DNA, which is a set of instructions that tells our bodies how to make themselves and how to act, there's also this secondary set of instructions, epigenetics, that regulates how that script or how our DNA's script is actually activated. One good analogy I've heard is that your DNA is kind of if you think about a movie, that it's a script for the movie, but epigenetics is the instructions on how it should be directed or how it should be enacted. Anyway, the interesting thing here is it's become, scientists have begun to think that there are environmental things that affect your epigenetics. And by that I mean certain things that you do or are subjected to, or in the case of diet, that you eat, that might cause certain parts of your DNA to become activated or inactivated. So that itself is really interesting, to think that what you eat can actually affect the expression of your genes and cause a health problem or a health benefit.
So if your diet today can affect your children and your grandchildren, what should you have for dinner tonight?
That is a question that no one knows the precise answer to, because so much of this is unknown. You know, we don't even know how what we eat affects us, let alone how it affects our kids, let alone how it might affect our grandkids. But what I can say that, you know, the way I deal with that uncertainty is to try to hedge my bets by eating foods that I know naturally contain a lot of vitamins. And my logic there is that if they naturally contain vitamins, they naturally likely contain other beneficial compounds that we might not even know the names of, certainly you might not know the effects of, but that probably are doing good things for us. So for me, what I do is try to not freak out about how much is unknown, not try to chase down the latest headlines about vitamin D or resveratrol or lycopene or whatever else you'll find in newspapers and women's magazines, and instead just try to eat what a 1920s biochemist called a protective diet, and it's a term I love because it's basically the idea that you don't have to have all the answers. Just eat a variety of foods that you believe have some sort of protective effect. The idea of synergy is basically that if you take things in isolation, they're not going to act the same as they will if they're in their original context. And you can see this with people. You know, a person in their comfortable context in their home with their family is going to be very different if, for example, you pull them on stage and ask them to perform on The Voice, right? There's going to be, or if you just put them in a group of people that they've never been with before. There's all sorts of interactions that you can't necessarily predict, but that are definitely different. And the same same is true for food, where, you know, a vitamin C that's isolated in a pill may not act exactly the same as vitamin C that is naturally present in an orange with all sorts of other stuff in it. And so I just think that that's an important thing for people to keep in mind as a caution, especially as the food industry and the supplement industry starts coming out with more and more of these plant chemical dietary supplements or these whole food powders, quote unquote, or just products that attempt to isolate some of these chemicals in the same way that vitamins are isolated so and give it to us that way.
Sounds like a protective diet that's broadly based is your answer.
Yeah, I mean, and it's not, you know, it's not like, it's not the most exciting thing. People are like, oh, I know I should be eating more vegetables. But what I like about it is it gives it a name. It gives you kind of a fun-sounding name that allows you to identify yourself with something. Because I think Americans really love to have their identity associated with food. They want to be gluten-free. They want to be vegetarian. They want to be paleo. You know, they want to be vegan after six. So now you can say, yeah, I don't really bother with that. I just eat a protective diet.
Readers, Vitamania is a fascinating read. Surprisingly amusing and with really deep research on the history of how we got to the stage we are now and with some really good prescriptions on how to proceed. As Catherine was saying, the protective diet, which is so simple, may be the best way to proceed for the future. So thanks so much for joining us today, Catherine. It was really great to hear from you.
Thank you.
And now let's listen to a sampling of Vitamania, our obsessive quest for nutritional perfection, read by Aaron Bennett.
The very power of vitamins makes them a double-edged sword. Their ability to save lives has promulgated the idea that they can perform miracles in all of us, regardless of whether we're actually deficient. This, in turn, has led to beliefs in vitamins that are based more on faith than fact. When we seek out vitamins today, it's not because we're worried about night blindness, or pellagra, or beriberi, or any of the other conditions that vitamins can actually prevent and cure. True vitamin deficiency diseases have become so uncommon in the developed world that most of us don't even know their names. Instead, we use vitamins as insurance policies against whatever else we might or might not be eating. As if by atoning for our other nutritional sins, vitamins can save us from ourselves. We think that vitamins will help us live longer and stay healthier, even prevent or reverse disease. Perhaps that's why when we hear the word vitamin, our minds often jump immediately to pills, turning substances found naturally in foods into something we don't just eat, but take. Yet while we all know that medicines can have side effects, and that no one drug could possibly solve all our problems, we assume that vitamins are both panaceas and entirely risk-free. In a way, our attraction to vitamins and general obsession with nutrition is perfectly logical. Our well-being is affected by what we eat, and no one wants to be sick. But that doesn't explain how the term vitamin, a word coined by a Polish biochemist before any vitamin had been chemically identified, has come to be synonymous with health. Isn't it odd, for example, that cyanocobalamin and alpha-tocopherol sound intimidating, even sinister, while vitamins B12 and E, which are names for the same substances, seem incontrovertibly good? Isn't it strange that we worry about hydrogenated oils, high fructose corn syrup, artificial sweeteners, and GMOs, but allow synthetic vitamins to be added to nearly anything without question, and then use the very presence of those vitamins to define the food as healthy? How can we simultaneously harbor distrust toward drug makers and accept extravagant claims on foods and supplements whose manufacturers make billions of dollars from us each year at face value? If we were to ask these questions, we might reach an uncomfortable conclusion that both individually and as a society, we have been seduced by a word. Despite its influence on our daily lives, most of us are unaware of this seduction. I know this from personal experience. I'm a journalist with a particular interest in health and nutrition, and I also have type 1 diabetes an incurable autoimmune disease that forces me to pay constant attention to how what I eat will affect my body. I inspect nutrition facts panels whenever I encounter them, and I follow stories about nutrition the way that other people follow sports. For reasons both personal and professional, my life depends on being knowledgeable and thoughtful about food. As a result, until recently, I thought I understood vitamins. I could tell you that they are essential substances that we need to get from our diets, and like anyone who paid attention in fifth grade, I was aware that sailors used to suffer from something called scurvy. But I didn't really understand why animals and plants need vitamins, how they were discovered, or even the technical definition of what a vitamin actually is. Instead, like many people, I just aimed for 100% of my daily requirements, ate a lot of kale, popped a multivitamin when I remembered it, and bought into the common assumption that the more vitamins a food contained, the better for me it must be.
That was Vitamania by Katherine Price. Dish up the red meat, eggs, and whole milk. In The Big Fat Surprise, Why Butter, Meat, and Cheese Belong in a Healthy Diet, veteran food writer Nina Teicholz proves how everything we've been told about fat is wrong. For decades, Americans have cut back on red meat and dairy products full of bad saturated fats. We obediently complied with nutritional guidelines to eat heart healthy. Fats found in olive oil, fish, and nuts, and followed a Mediterranean diet heavy on fruits, vegetables, and grains. Yet the nation's health has declined. Why? Teicholz reveals how 60 years of nutrition science has gotten it so wrong. How overzealous researchers have made basic scientific mistakes that, through a mix of ego and bias, allowed dangerous misrepresentations to become dogma. And how scientists who dared oppose this consensus have been ostracized. For 8 years, Teicholz has pored over the massive research literature and interviewed hundreds of experts to unravel the shockingly distorted claims of nutritional studies. Erin Bennett performs the book.
There's a popular assumption that the profit-driven food industry must be at the root of all our dietary troubles, that somehow food companies are responsible for corrupting nutrition recommendations toward their own corporate ends. And it's true, they're no angels. In fact, the story of vegetable oils, including trans fats, is partly about how food companies stifled science to protect an ingredient vital to their industry. Yet I discovered that on the whole, the mistakes of nutrition science could not primarily be pinned on the nefarious interests of big food. The source of our misguided dietary advice was in some ways more disturbing, since it seems to have been driven by experts at some of our most trusted institutions working toward what they believe to be the public good. Part of the problem is easy to understand. These researchers ran up against an enduring problem in nutrition science, which is that much of it turns out to be highly fallible. Most of our dietary recommendations are based on studies that try to measure what people eat and then follow them for years to see how their health fares. It is, of course, extremely difficult to trace a direct line from a particular element in the diet to disease outcomes many years later, especially given all the other lifestyle factors and variables at play. The data that emerge from these studies are weak and impressionistic. Yet in the drive to fight heart disease, and later obesity and diabetes, these weak data have had to suffice. And this compromise by researchers appears to have driven many of nutrition policy's failures, well-intentioned experts hastening to address growing epidemics of chronic disease simply overinterpreted the data. Indeed, the disturbing story of nutrition science over the course of the last half century looks something like this. Scientists responding to the skyrocketing number of heart disease cases, which had gone from a mere handful in 1900 to being the leading cause of death by 1950, hypothesized that dietary fat, especially of the saturated kind, due to its effect on cholesterol, was to blame. This hypothesis became accepted as truth before it was properly tested. Public health bureaucracies adopted and enshrined this unproven dogma. The hypothesis became immortalized in the mammoth institutions of public health. And the normally self-correcting mechanism of science, which involves constantly challenging one's own beliefs, was disabled. While good science should be ruled by skepticism and self-doubt, the field of nutrition has instead been shaped by passions verging on zealotry. And the whole system by which ideas are canonized as fact seems to have failed us. Once ideas about fat and cholesterol became adopted by official institutions, even prominent experts in the field found it nearly impossible to challenge them. One of the 20th century's most revered nutrition scientists, the organic chemist David Krichevsky, discovered this 30 years ago when, on a panel for the National Academy of Sciences, he suggested loosening the restrictions on dietary fat. "We were jumped on," he told me. "People would spit on us." It's hard to imagine now, the heat of the passion. It was just like we had desecrated the American flag. They were so angry that we were going against the suggestions of the American Heart Association and the National Institutes of Health.
That was The Big Fat Surprise by Nina Teicholz. A renowned personal trainer to Olympic athletes, movie stars, and supermodels, Joel Harper, who is Dr. Oz's personal trainer and regular contributor, draws on 20 years of experience to create a powerful three-step fitness approach, combining mindful techniques with effective workouts to achieve impressive results in only 15 minutes a day. New research in neuroscience and neuropsychology shows that negative thinking prevents people from improving bad health and shedding excess weight. As the research makes clear, your mindset is a crucial factor when it comes to slimming down, toning up, and boosting your overall well-being. Mind Your Body, narrated by the author, provides simple, effective ways to harness your brain power to make lasting changes.
Later on, I came to understand that no one was out to hurt me. People are largely unaware of the lasting impact words can have on someone's self-image. I'm sure that if the people in my life realized I would carry around those nicknames well into adulthood, they never would have used them. Like most kids, I was mortified at the thought of being different. So I developed my own version of shapewear. I would wear sweatpants and heavy shirts under my regular clothes to add bulk and padding to hide my defects. Sometimes I even had to put on two layers under my jeans to get the desired appearance. I can still remember sweat pouring down my back, stomach, and legs on those hot, humid Texas days, all in the name of being normal. My awakening. At 17, something happened that would change the course of my self-perception forever. I was approached by a local modeling agency and started doing some local fashion shoots. This was my first clue that my lean physique might actually be an asset. My self-perception began to change. Maybe, just maybe, I thought, I may not be bones. While my experience with modeling helped me break free of my old image and those childhood messages, I was surprised to learn that many models had distorted images of themselves. Some perceived themselves as fat or ugly or having some other imperfection. These were models working for clients like Versace and Armani, specifically because they were perceived as perfect. I remember one stunningly beautiful woman saying, "God, I hate my body. I'm in the worst shape ever. Just look at this cellulite." She would go to the gym and work out at 11 at night after a full day of intense photo shoots. I watched other models pursue rigid food-restricting regimens or insanely intense workouts. Many people, not just models and celebrities, suffer from insecurity, anxiety, and sometimes erratic or extreme mood swings that keep them from being whole and happy, These people believe they deserve to be perceived as beautiful or to lose weight, get fit, earn money, only if they practice almost torture-grade fitness and weight loss strategies, find a magic pill, or employ some other drastic measure. More often, people just don't believe they deserve to lose weight. Instead, they believe that they are overweight because they deserve it at some level. The key here is what you perceive is what you will manifest. You might be beautiful outside, but miserable inside. Or you may truly struggle with excess weight. Either way, what you ultimately believe about yourself will become your truth. And belief lives only in your thoughts. That's why the right frame of mind, attitudes, beliefs, and internal thinking strategies are key to achieving a truly successful, balanced, and emotionally secure life. Learning that mindset matters. When I first started training others, I would often scratch my head, baffled that when I gave two similar clients nearly identical programs, the results could be extremely different. I remember two clients, let's call them Sally and Jane, who each wanted to lose roughly 25 pounds, establish a regular fitness routine, and begin healthier eating habits. From the start, I noted that Sally was positive about starting a new path toward improved health, but Jane was pessimistic from the get-go. I've lost and gained weight so many times, but, sigh, I'm willing to give this another try. Both women reached their goals in a reasonable amount of time. But while Sally found happiness and fulfillment in her achievement, Jane continually expressed dissatisfaction, barely noticing her accomplishments and complaining increasingly that she hadn't lost enough weight. Jane began to make excuses and miss appointments, even though she was paying for them. Not surprisingly, her weight began to creep back up. Here we go again, she told me. Nothing ever works for me. Jane's mind was already made up, and what she was really telling me was that she believed she deserved to fail. And so, she did. When people don't truly and deeply believe they deserve something, they don't make positive choices or take actions needed to reach their goals. By contrast, Sally sustained her weight loss, felt empowered by her success, and continued to train regularly and improve on her fitness goals. Sally came to me already believing that she deserved better health and weight loss, so she was willing to take the steps to make her dream a reality. Based on the experience of Sally and Jane, as well as countless other clients, I began to formulate strategies to help my clients look at their existing beliefs and chip away at negative and self-defeating messages, concentrating on self-belief and self-worth.
We've just heard Mind Your Body by Joel Harper. Researching top health and nutrition books, this one by Cameron Diaz kept coming up. Reviewers agree it's not just a celebrity vanity project. Cameron shares her formula for becoming happier, healthier, and stronger in a guide grounded in science and inspired by personal experience. By Cameron's own candid admission, this glamorous but down-to-earth star was not always health conscious. Learning about the inseparable link between nutrition and the body was just one of the life-changing lessons that fed Cameron's hunger to educate herself. The Body Book offers a comprehensive overview of the human body and mind from the cellular level up. From demystifying and debunking the hype around food groups to explaining the value of vitamins and minerals, listeners discover why it's important to embrace the instinct of hunger and to satisfy it with whole, nutrient-dense foods. Cameron also explains the essential role of movement, the importance of muscle and bone strength, and why we need to sweat a little every day. Cameron, who shares the narration with Sandy Rustin, offers a holistic, long-term approach to making consistent choices and reaching the ultimate goal, a long, strong, happy, healthy life.
When I think of protein, I think of barbecues, of Cuban feasts, and my favorite snack of quinoa, lentils, and brown rice. I love to have a yummy roasted chicken for dinner or for breakfast. For lunch, maybe a light and delicious piece of grilled fish. I also adore having a big pot of black beans going on the stove, perfect for making tacos or enjoying with a side of brown rice. In fact, I love all kinds of beans. And of course, as anyone who has ever set foot in my house knows, lentils of every color. And, as anyone who has ever come over for breakfast knows, they'll be offered one preparation or another of eggs. Scrambled, fried, sunny side up, in a frittata, any way you can think of, eggs will be served. The word protein means of prime importance, and protein is certainly important to our health. Proteins are made up of amino acids. Amino acids and proteins are so vital to our health that they are regularly referred to as the building blocks of life. The amino acid trip. When you eat protein, your body breaks it down into its smallest components, amino acids. Amino acids are molecules that are used to build and repair all of the cells in your body, including your DNA. Scientists disagree on the exact number of amino acids that exist, but it's thought that there are about 20 amino acids that combine to make proteins. As an adult woman, your body can formulate nearly two-thirds of them. Two-thirds is good, but unfortunately, it's just not good enough. There are 8 amino acids that we must get from nutrition, and these are the essential amino acids. Every single day, each of these essential amino acids is required for your body to maintain your health. As we've discussed, when you eat carbs and fats, your body can store away some of the excess for later use, whether you like it or not. But protein is different. Amino acids cannot be stored in the body, so the best way to eat protein isn't to sit down to a giant caveman-style slab of meat at the end of the day, but to eat small portions of protein steadily throughout the day. That way, the amino acids are always available for your body to use. How much is enough? When you hear people talking about nutrition, everyone's always talking about getting enough protein. What does enough look like? Protein should make up roughly 35% of your total daily calories, which means that one-third of your breakfast bowl, your lunchbox, and your dinner plate should be a healthy protein. Children, teens, and pregnant women need even more because protein supports growth and development. For the rest of us, eating enough protein will ensure that we can build and maintain our muscles and our bones, as well as the antibodies that keep us healthy, the hormones that affect our mood, and the enzymes that make digestion possible. Without protein, you wouldn't be able to go on a dinner date, fall in love, throw your arms around someone's neck, and feel your heart race as you kissed. The amount of protein each of us needs is a little bit different because our protein requirements are based on our body weight and our physical activity. After all, it makes sense that it wouldn't be a one-size-fits-all equation because the more or less you weigh, the more or fewer cells you have. And if you're super physically active, let's say you're training for a marathon, for example, your body is constantly building and repairing muscle, so you're going to need more protein than someone who runs 3 miles a few times a week. Basically, the more active you are, the more strength training you do and the more your body weighs, the more protein you need to support your form and let your body heal and rebuild. The chart on the PDF will tell you how much protein you want to be eating based on your activity and on your body weight.
That was The Body Book by Cameron Diaz. Foodist by Daria Pino Rose is a manifesto about real food and real science that proves that sustainable weight loss is possible by incorporating fresh, seasonal, and delicious ingredients into every meal. Dieting is a popular hobby in the 21st century, and the result is typically a slow but steady weight gain. Whoops. Diets fail because they rely on willpower and restriction for achieving health goals and ignore the reasons these tactics always backfire. Becoming a foodist helps you give up dieting forever and get on the real path to healthy, lasting weight control. Foodist is an approach that actually celebrates food while taking you through the nutrition and psychology involved in eating well. Losing weight no longer has to be about sacrifice and deprivation. As Daria, who narrates, writes, you don't need a diet, you need an upgrade.
In retrospect, the most interesting part is not that I tried all these diets. Clearly, I was not alone in my efforts. But that I was good at them. I was very thin, i.e. successful, on my low-fat regimen in high school. I was a ballerina and definitely looked the part. After I stopped dancing and put some weight back on, I had no trouble abandoning bread, rice, and potatoes for several years while I got back down to a size zero on the Atkins diet. I gladly woke up at 5 a.m. for two-hour workouts every weekday and clocked three-hour long runs every Sunday for marathon training during my first few years of graduate school. Though my successes may have been fleeting, a weak will has never been the reason. The problem wasn't me. The problem was that starving yourself of energy, nutrients, and pleasure is not the most effective way to attain, let alone maintain, the body you want. It is also no way to live your life. Chronic dieters believe that success comes from sacrifice. If only we could deprive ourselves a little more, punish our bodies even harder, then we could finally look amazing and, of course, be happy. But as someone who has tortured herself in every way imaginable, I can guarantee you that this path does not lead to happiness. Why? Because it turns life into a constant struggle. You never really win if you're dieting. When you are constantly depriving yourself, happiness is always just out of reach. So even if you could confidently identify the best, most effective restrictive diet, why should this be your goal? Shouldn't there be more to life than constantly denying yourself the things you enjoy? Now you're thinking like a foodist. As simple and logical as this sounds, I know from experience that ending deprivation is tough for chronic dieters. No pain, no gain is fundamental to our psyche. Don't we deserve to suffer for being so fat? Most of us have been victims of a vicious, convoluted feedback loop through which we are rewarded for our sacrifices with temporary, but often dramatic, weight loss at the beginning of each new diet. This creates the illusion of success, but you have to ask yourself, shouldn't real success be defined by lasting, not temporary, weight loss? Nutritionists and MDs haven't helped much either. Virtually all weight loss experts tell us we need to eat less and move more to lose weight, with the obvious implication being that we need to diet, deprive ourselves, and exercise, suffer at the gym, to achieve our goals. You can't break the first law of thermodynamics. It's science. But this line of thinking neglects the reasons we are compelled to overeat in the first place and doesn't give us the tools we need to actually implement their simple eat less, move more, lose weight equation. It also implies that failure stems from a lack of willpower. Why aren't you eating less like you're supposed to? Rather than from a plan that fails to account for the nuances of the human psyche. How many people do you know who eat solely for fuel? All the thin people, right? Not a chance. Sure, we all sometimes eat because we're hungry, but the specific foods we choose and how much we eat are largely influenced by our habits and environment. In other words, it is not the concept of eating less to lose weight that is wrong, but the idea that we can lose weight and keep it off without accounting for why we make the choices we do. My own experiences convinced me that willpower was not the missing piece of the equation. After all, I was following all the rules, but maintaining my weight was still a constant struggle. At the time, I didn't know what I was missing, but I was confident that humans have not always had this problem and that something about our current weight loss paradigm must be wrong. It wasn't until my second year of grad school that I realized I finally had enough training in biology to go directly to the scientific literature for answers. Before, I had relied on diet books and magazine articles to fumble my way through different weight loss strategies. Now that I had the knowledge and lab experience to read and understand the science, I wanted to see the data for myself. Not surprisingly, even at this stage, I went about my research all wrong. From my chronic dieter's perspective, I was looking for the perfect diet, partially expecting some version of low carb to be the answer. This had been the easiest, after all. So in the beginning, my findings were very discouraging. The first thing I learned is that for the most part, diets don't work for long-term weight loss. In fact, going on some sort of weight loss diet is actually a significant predictor of weight gain. So, that said, you can lose weight, at least for a little while, on any diet.
That was Foodist by Daria Pino Rose. Selection on the book report is on topic, but a little twisted, and certainly fun and informative. Just 2 months before the September 11 terrorist attacks, Dr. Judy Melnick began her training as a New York City forensic pathologist. Judy threw herself into a world that fascinated her, performing autopsies, investigating death scenes, and counseling grieving relatives. In Working Stiff, 2 years, 262 bodies, and the makings of a medical examiner, Judy takes listeners behind the police tape. Working Stiff offers a firsthand account of daily life in one of America's most arduous professions. The body never lies. And through the murders, accidents, and suicides that land on her table, Dr. Melnick lays bare the truth behind the glamorized depictions of autopsy work to reveal the secret story of the real morgue. Author Kathy Reichs comments, "Far from the magic we see on TV, Working Stiff describes forensic pathology in the real world. This book is a compelling and absorbing read." Tanya Eby narrates.
I'm not a ghoulish person. I'm a guileless, sunny optimist, in fact. When I first started training in death investigation, TJ worried my new job would change the way I looked at the world. He feared that after a few months of hearing about the myriad ways New Yorkers die, the two of us would start looking up nervously for window air conditioners to fall on our heads. Maybe we'd steer Danny's stroller around sidewalk grates instead of rolling over them. We would, he was sure, never again set foot in murderous Central Park.
"You're going to turn me into one of those crazy people who leaves the house wearing a surgical mask and gloves," he declared during a West Nile virus scare.
Instead, my experience had the opposite effect. It freed me, and eventually my husband as well, from our 6 o'clock news phobias. Once I became an eyewitness to death, I found that nearly every unexpected fatality I investigated was either the result of something dangerously mundane or of something predictably hazardous. So don't jaywalk. Wear your seatbelt when you drive. Better yet, stay out of your car and get some exercise. Watch your weight. If you're a smoker, stop right now. If you aren't, don't start. Guns put holes in people. Drugs are bad. You know that yellow line on the subway platform? It's there for a reason. Staying alive, as it turns out, is mostly common sense. Mostly. As I would also learn at the New York City office of Chief Medical Examiner, undetected anatomical defects do occasionally cause otherwise healthy people to drop dead. 1 in a million fatal diseases crop up, and New York has 8 million people. There are open manholes, stray bullets. There are crane accidents. I don't understand how you can do it. Friends, even fellow physicians, tell me. But all doctors learn to objectify their patients to a certain extent. You have to suppress your emotional responses or you wouldn't be able to do your job. In some ways, it's easier for me because a dead body really is an object, no longer a person at all. More important, that dead body is not my only patient. The survivors are the ones who really matter. I work for them, too. I didn't start off wanting to be a forensic pathologist. You don't say to yourself in second grade, "When I grow up, I want to cut up dead people." It's not what you think a doctor should do. A doctor should heal people. My dad was that kind of doctor. He was the chief of emergency room psychiatry at Jacoby Medical Center in the Bronx. My father instilled in me a fascination with how the human body works. He'd kept all his medical school textbooks, and when I started asking questions, he would pull those tomes off their high shelf so we could explore the anatomical drawings together. The books were explorer's charts, and he moved with such ease over them, with such assurance and enthusiasm, that I figured if I became a doctor, I could sail those seas with him.
We've just heard a sampling of Working Stiff by Dr. Judy Melnick with Thomas Mitchell. Readers, so much to consider when it comes to health. Vitamins, yes. Vitamins, no. Red meat and eggs, good. Red meat and eggs, so very bad. The key is to do the research. I hope I've helped today with new titles that present sound evidence upon which to base your choices. For more titles in every genre, be sure to check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks for joining me today. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.